Hey, Rick. This is your producer, Lise Graham, and I just wanted to say congratulations on hitting episode 200 of After Hours with Rick Kogan. I'm so proud of you and so thankful to be a part of this amazing show. You've talked to, since I've started, politicians, writers, filmmakers, poets, so many inspiring and influential people to me, and you've just taught me so much about persistence, patience, and really you've given me a lot of hope for working in this industry. So thank you so much, and here's to 200 more. Listen.
Well, thanks, Lise Graham. 200 shows in this crazy business is not that big a deal, but the thought and the emotion is appreciated. Okay, and here's to 200 more. You'll be running the station by then, so maybe I can get a better time slot. Dick Simpson's new book is titled The Good Fight, and it's an aptly titled book because he has been, for his entire career as alderman, as activist, as pundit, been fighting the good fight. He writes at the beginning of this book, "In the good fight, I attempt to tell the truth about my life, including some details kept private until now. For although I have sought to live an honorable life, I, like all mortals, have fallen short. Wherever I have done well, and especially where I have failed, I would like what wisdom I have gained to flow into the world to help us all in the good fight." Dick Simpson, welcome to the show, and congratulations on this book.
Thank you, Rick.
It's a revelation to me. I've known you for a very, very long time, for decades,
decades
now.
Decades, yes.
And I'm literally, I see you in the lobby of the station. I go, "Jeez, I didn't know you were from Texas. I didn't know you were a Boy Scout. I didn't know you were a minister." What prompted this book, Dick? Because it's a very, as you say, it's a very honest look at your life.
I did want to reflect back. I'm at an age where reflection about the past and trying to make sense of it is a task that we older folk do. And I wanted to be able to reflect not just for me, but for you're in my generation.
Yeah.
Because many of the chapters are about other people like Linda Prey or people like Ray Nordstrand.
Studs Terkel, Clark Netsch.
All of them, yeah. A pantheon, because I wasn't alone. Nearly everybody who came up in the 60s and 70s, came of political age and conscious age, were transformed by the time. Now, of course, we were a little arrogant. We thought we'd fix
the world.
We'd fix it. No, maybe a year or two. You know, it was a small task. In fact, I remember in the McCarthy campaign, I was state campaign manager for Eugene McCarthy in 68, thinking, well, we'll just elect a president. We'll work our way down. We'll fix everything else because we have a new president.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, we didn't elect a president, and then 48, 50 years later, we're still not quite fixed.
Yeah, and we don't have quite a president.
No.
Is that a huge disappointment to you? Because I do not find this book, I certainly find the end a hopeful note. I mean, you remain hopeful in the face of all the stuff we've been through, don't you?
Yes, partly because we've been through so much. I mean, in terms of the Trump era, I remember the Reagan era. Reagan was cutting the social services, for instance, and beefing up the military and doing a lot of other things, but particularly cutting the social services. He was going to cut Chicago and the local governments $440 million, according to the bookkeeping by Harold Washington and his staff down at the City Hall. That was back then a huge cut, and it was going to be very damaging. And we were able to mobilize enough people to force the Congress to block it.
Sure.
So in one sense, I've seen this movie before.
Yeah.
That helps give a little bit of perspective that this too will pass. I also think that when we go through trials and tribulations, that frequently on the other side, we have the chance to make a leap forward. To take a different example, Rod Blagojevich's corruption
mm-hmm.
spurred the state to actually finally pass some laws and to make some improvements in curbing corruption. Now, we've had 2,000 convicted officials go to jail since 1960.
Well, that was the last time you were on the air. Yeah, right. It was a book where the statistics were among the most shocking that I've ever encountered. It was something like, I cannot remember the number of city council members.
Oh, we're only at 35 who've gone to jail since I was
all?
There.
You know? Gee, that's crazy.
There are 50 members in the council, about 100 or two since I was there, but...
Dick, what is it about, and we'll get deep into the book, what is it about politics doesn't breed corruption? I don't think. I think that it can nurture corruption. I do not believe that someone gets into politics and then there are inducements, there are seductions out there, but does it attract, especially local politics, does it attract a kind of unsavory crowd that is prone to stick their hand out?
Well, I remember your dad's book about the Lords of the Levy.
Oh, yeah. those guys set a high bar, though. Yeah. Hinky Dink and Bathhouse John.
But the truth is we've had machine politics in Chicago since 1871. Mm-hmm. When Michael Cassius McDonald
founded the first fire.
The Great Chicago Fire. And we've continued ever since. And when you have nepotism, when you have patronage, when you have a repressive machine that doesn't let the little guy even venture to have opinions or do something against the party, you build a culture of corruption. And that history and culture then mean that the good people like the Rick Kogans aren't going to go into this line of work.
Yeah, that's why I want to know why you went into this in the first place. Because years ago, in 2006, long after you'd left the council, I got it in my head, and it was the worst year that I can remember in my career of journalism, where I decided to interview all 50 of the aldermen because I couldn't name them all, and I thought that was atrocious. We are going to talk this whole hour with Dick Simpson. His new book is The Good Fight, Life Lessons from a Chicago Progressive. Before we take a commercial break, do you call this... I am not fond of the word memoir. I literally think of this as an autobiography.
I usually use the word memoir for this, but it is closer to an autobiography. And I think of it, like I say, as the story of our generation, even though it's a very personal story, the only way I could tell it.
Well, but it's a very interesting personal story set against an incredibly vivid backdrop. No question. Chicago politics.
Well, between segregationist Texas and the machine control Chicago, I chose some interesting places
to live. You're in the right
place
at the right time. There are also some adorable pictures of the young Dick Simpson as a Boy Scout. We'll talk about that after a short break.
Hey, Rick, it's Todd Manley. I know I'm supposed to congratulate you on your 200th After Hours show, but in my head it's more like 200,000 shows. Every Chicago story I've ever heard is better if I imagine you telling it. And the stories you've actually told, I want to hear over and over again. So congrats. Man, you are loved around here. And I'm just a little bit ticked off that your career as a singer-songwriter with Rimowa Brothers has been overlooked.
It's an honor. Yeah. Really, I consider it a real honor. Dick Simpson's just telling me how honored he is to be a member of the 200th show. That's Todd Manley giving and thinking that I'm always a member of the Rimowa Brothers. Dick Simpson, you're a child of Texas at a very, very interesting time in Texas, and you were, like many members of your generation, my generation, our generation, a Boy Scout.
Yes.
You were real. I mean, you were a serious Boy Scout.
Yeah, I got all those Eagle. I had three Eagle Awards of different sorts, silver and God and Country. Yeah.
You also write here, your parents look like lovely people, and you were just the cutest kid. Again, Dick's book, The Good Fight, is liberally illustrated with pictures from his life, not just his career as a politician and professor and activist. You write it early on in the book and echo it later on. You say, one thing all my favorite books, TV shows, and movies had in common, heroes who worked to change the world for the better. That's a very interesting observation to me.
Yeah, I grew up, you know, reading Westerns, reading science fiction, hearing about people like Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson. And the strange thing was, maybe it's just I was so isolated as a kid and growing up in Texas in the 50s, I believed all that stuff.
Yeah.
Somehow the other people didn't seem to believe it, but I did. And so I thought that that's how you were supposed to live your life, that you were supposed to you know, be involved in changing the world, and that's what people did that were honorable or normal people. I didn't know that most people ducked out on that second part.
Yeah. Well, like many people, too, of that age and that era, you got married relatively young because in many ways, I mean, you were in love, and no question
right.
about that, to this lovely woman named Mary Scott Head, and but that's what people did, too. You got married, right?
Yeah. I had finished my undergraduate career and had gone to Indiana University. And the first day on campus as a graduate student, I ran into Scott and on an elevator. We were going up in the student union. And she had been a leader of the local student Y, and I had been a leader of the national student YMCA, YWCA. That I'd gotten in partly because of the civil rights movement, but that's another part of the book.
Exactly. Sure. Sure. You know? Well, because you saw the some very ugly racial feelings growing up in Texas.
We were a completely segregated state, much like the South. There were three classes of people: blacks, who were at the bottom.
Yep.
Latinos, who were next, and then whites, who were on top. And it was like this, what you see in the movies about the Old South.
Yeah.
But by the time I got to the University of Texas, before I got to Indiana and met Scott, I was part of the civil rights movement. In fact, the book starts with the story of the bomb that was thrown at our meeting.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be here now 50 years later with you bomb had worked. But the nice thing about Texas redneck kids is they're not very good bomb makers. Now they've got manuals on the internet, and they might do better. They blew out a few bricks, blew out a window, threw shrapnel 25 yards, but didn't hurt any of us. So in next week, we started the civil rights movement to integrate all the theaters of Texas.
Yeah.
And we succeeded, which was a surprising part of that. We integrated immediately in 6-month campaign over 100 theaters throughout the country. We would stand in these long lines in front of the theater, blacks and whites together, and a black and white would go up to the ticket taker and say, I'd like to have two tickets to go see the theater for whatever movie was on.
Sure.
And, of course, the ticket taker would say, well, no, the black has to go up. They didn't use the word black those days.
Of
they
course.
Used other. They used the N-word.
Yeah.
Has to go up in the balcony. You can't sit on the first floor with the white people. And so we'd get turned down and go back to line, and we'd have a picket line out front so people would know it just wasn't a popular movie. It was a protest. But the people driving by, besides the first bad bomb that didn't work, were throwing beer bottles and catcalls and nigger lover and all those kinds of epithets. And some of our leaders got death threats. It was, you know, it wasn't beanbag, as they say in Chicago.
Yeah,
this
sure.
This was the real thing in the South. But we persevered. And in Texas, we won great victories, just like much of the nation.
What was it like in Indiana?
Indiana was much more polite. I've always thought of Bloomington.
That's the word.
Bloomington, Indiana, you know, they had a political party, but it wasn't a machine like Chicago. Mm-hmm. They had blacks being treated less well, but they weren't segregationist. They were, you know, polite about mistreating black students in the Indiana University.
And you and your bride wind up you wind up in Africa.
Yes.
You see, that's another aspect. I was saying at the beginning of this show that Dick and I have known each other for, you know, maybe 40 years, and there's so much in this book that came as a revelation to me. What were you doing in Africa?
So after the civil rights movement and part of growing up, I went to Africa first to build a YMCA
mm-hmm.
with other college students, and we did that in Sino, Liberia. And then I came back, and because of the civil rights movement, I went into African studies. So originally I was an African scholar or an Africanist, not an urbanist, not an American politics person. So we ended up in Africa doing the longest period was when Scott and I went there for a year, and I did my research for my dissertation. And I was – it's an interesting study I was doing. You know, Americans and Russians were equally stupid back then. Mm-hmm. We thought we knew how to develop the world, and we had a very simple idea. Both sides, both the communists and the capitalists, we thought that if you had social and economic development, political development would follow. We only differed in – you know, we thought that they would become good Americans and have democracy, and the Russians thought they'd become good communists and have the Soviet Union take over the world. Well, we were both wrong, and I studied two upcountry towns. They were provincial capitals, but they only had 5,000 people, and the long and the short of it was the more socially and economically developed town had the least political participation.
Interesting.
Lots of complicated reasons, and I got my job here. I was stupid. I came here after the 67 snow, and the snow was still on the ground. And
to get a job,
I'm teaching
African and American politics.
That's right. I came here to teach
what
African
politics.
They used
to call Circle. You know, in those days, 67 Circle was just being built.
Yes,
I remember it well. My uncle was in the English department there, and it was a mess.
It was a mess. And, you know, I had interesting students. I was teaching African studies to Carol Moseley Braun, who became U.S. Senator and presidential candidate.
Sure,
and others. You know,
one of the great things about Circle then and maybe even now is it was such an urban campus. It was such a city kind of college. I mean, the kids were coming from all over the place, and many of them in that era is the first generation to go to college.
Still true. We're the only campus. We're one of the most diverse campuses in America, particularly a big campus of 30,000. We are a minority white campus.
Exactly.
We have blacks, Latinos, Asians, and then we have whites.
Yep.
They're not the smallest group. They're a large group, but they're outnumbered by everybody else. And we have international students. We have always been a feisty campus. It's not really – I mean, I don't know why we haven't won Nobel Prizes more. Our sister campus at Urbana has, but we haven't. But we have some of the best scholars in the world, everything from nuclear physicists
No question. I think,
I mean, we taught every Chicago political historian has been trained at UNC.
I know. I went there for a time, but I do remember my uncle, Bernard, who was a scholar, a Dickens scholar and a Haymarket Riot scholar.
That's well, it goes together.
A
tale of two cities and Haymarket.
No,
that makes perfect sense.
We got to take a break now. At least we have to take a break, right? Before news. Okay, we have to take a break. We will then come back and we will meet Dick Simpson when he's watching televised reports of Chicago police beating up protesters in Grant Park. You and your wife hop on the L and rush to join the demonstrations. That's where we'll be after a short commercial break and some news.
Congratulations on 200 episodes, Rick. There is no one like you in Chicago radio. You're a Chicago treasure, and I'm proud to call you a WGN radio treasure as well. It was such a joy to be your producer in 2009. Thank you for being that gravelly-voiced man on Sunday mornings and now Sunday nights. Thanks for being part of our WGN radio family. You're the best, kid.
Thanks, Aubrey, and thanks, Stephanie Menendez, one of my many producers, all of whom have gone on to either run stations or win Nobel Prizes or play the wide receiver for professional football teams.
By the way, Rick, you know, I
don't even mention, if you're going to mention 200 shows, I'll...
No, I wasn't going to mention that exactly, but, you know, I do about 100 media interviews a year of different sorts, all kinds. But I've only probably had three or four people in this situation who've actually read the material. You and Studs.
Well,
and Paul Lesnick.
That's
over
who taught me.
CLTV.
That's who Studs taught me.
Yeah, and it's a world of difference when you're doing this side of the interview and the host doesn't
That's the book. Very nice. Yeah. Well, because instead of asking the proverbial, so Dick, what's your book, The Good Fight? What's it about? Were you a boxer? What is it about? Were you a boxer? The Good Fight. You were working for Gene McCarthy during the 68 to do. What compelled you, a smart, rational human being, to decide that you wanted to be an alderman?
I guess I was really stupid because I actually knew better. I didn't know anything about Chicago politics before I came here, which sounds strange because I'm supposed to be a political scientist.
No, but you really weren't then.
Yeah.
It was African studies. And,
right. So I had not looked at Chicago at all. I'd been here once or twice to see friends. So I got here and I didn't know anything. And I became involved in the McCarthy campaign. And of course, we came up against Richard J. Daley and his police in a very direct way.
Uh-huh.
Also in the precincts.
Sure.
You know, I ran the 9th Congressional District before I ran the state campaign. And in the 9th Congressional District, we had delegate candidates for the convention, and we got a whole 20% of the vote. Now, of course, we got 40% in the 43rd and 44th wards, which mm-hmm. would go on to make the independent movement. But
right.
We got really beat badly in the precincts, and the guys in the precincts were not particularly nice fellows, as you know from
direct. No, the old precinct captain, of course not.
You know,
sure.
They hit you on the head.
Because their job's dependent on
that. That's
right. That was the gist of the patronage
system. And so I had seen that, and we started the independent precinct organization later, and we did battle with the machine and the Bernie Weisberg campaign and the Bill Singer campaign and the Don Clark Natch campaign and so forth. So I knew the machine from being their enemy for a long time. And we'd elected good people, but the liberals we had elected, like Bill Singer, Don Clark Natch, and others,
sure,
they did good liberal things, but they didn't have the sort of spirit of the 60s that it was all power to the people, that we ought to have participatory democracy.
Mm.
So I came along and said, well, I think I'll run myself because I want to push this participatory democracy idea. And I got elected because I was pretty good at the campaign craft, and it is a craft, like being a plumber.
Oh, no question.
I got elected, and I ended up in the city council. Now, once I got to the city council, I might as well have been back in the civil rights wars.
Yeah. Yeah, because those were in the days of Richard J. Daley, when it was an iron fist and there was no, you know, you had Len Dupre of the Fifth Ward in Hyde Park on the south side as sort of the lone voice of any kind, not even dissent, of any kind of contrary view.
Well, and I did like what the Negro Digest said, which is he was the only Negro representative in the city council, even though there were six others who were there at the time in the 50s and early 60s.
What did you learn? I think among many things, as you describe in The Good Fight, you learned what a difficult forget the trying to change the way the city works. The job of being an alderman is a difficult. I think you say it's 80 hours. You were working 80 hours a week.
Right. You are working, and, you know, the stuff that was fun was the fight in City Hall, interestingly enough, because then you felt like the knight in armor going down to do battle with the dragon.
One of your good guys.
And the press was nice. You know, they were heaping praise. Oh, Simpson today, you know, fought the machine, blah, blah, blah. But the other stuff, you know, you were dealing with 2,000 or 3,000 service complaints from constituents. And some of them, in fact, weren't very good complaints. I once had, on a Sunday, a funeral home director call me and say, under the Southport L, that the wastebasket had been turned over, and when was I going to get that fixed?
Oh,
well, I told him he should go pick up the waste paper, put it back in the basket, and we'd take care of it.
It really is it's like being the superintendent of a really, really, really large high-rise.
Yeah.
It's like fix my water, my garbage isn't getting picked up, and it's time-consuming.
It is, and, you know, my successor, Bruce Young, actually couldn't take the pressure because sometimes you can't win. I mean, someone gets evicted, and maybe they shouldn't be evicted, but you can't always get them back in their apartment.
Yep.
You can't always get their parking ticket fixed because they did really park in the wrong place. But and sometimes grandma can't live in the attic in a building that doesn't have two entrances and so on. So you can't win them all, and you just have to be able to understand winning most of them for citizens and building together a new community that's better than when you came is what matters, and you have to have that perspective. If you don't, you can't last.
Yeah, and you did that twice. It also takes you then ran, and this is another fascinating part of the book, you decided later on to run for Congress against a considerably formidable foe in Dan Rostenkowski.
One of the lessons in politics, I don't know whether I ever quite explicitly make it in the book anymore, but you really need to pick good enemies. I picked Richard J. Daley in the fight over the future of the city. And in the long run, we changed the laws, changed the budgets, changed the way Chicago runs. Created an independent movement and are slowly chipping away at the machine and corruption. But on the congressional level, the strongest congressman in America was Dan Rostenkowski, head of Ways and Means.
No question.
Daley's errand boy to make sure that Chicago got the goodies from Washington. But corrupt as hell. As we started to do the campaign, we put together a list of 17 different sets of corruption, not just the stamps that he's well known for, that he cashed in his stamps for $50,000 of illicit money he shouldn't have gotten, or that he used his workers to mow his lawn at his home, his vacation home, or that he, they went on and on. He got free cars for his daughters from the auto companies. He did a big deal down here at North Pier. He got the taxes reduced to zero, just about. He cut every kind of corner. He once said presidential towers should have been named after his four daughters because he got it there. Course, he did it with Charlie Schwabel, who was the crook of Chicago in the banking business.
Of course. Wow. That makes fascinating reading those congressional campaigns. And in part of all this, I want to spend the last segment of this talking about some personal things in here. But your affection for Harold Washington comes through, and you played a big part in that. It's too bad Harold died, because that would have been something if he had been able to live and maybe remain mayor for a while. We got to take a little break, and we'll come back and talk to Dick Simpson more about his fascinating memoir. You can call it a memoir, you can call it an autobiography, but it is his life. And his is an interesting, committed life set against the backdrop of all kinds of crazy Chicago politics and the changing world. We'll be right back.
This is John Williams, and my show begins with an announcer saying, thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. But the guy who really does that, eloquently, brilliantly, consistently, is Rick Hogan. How authentically Chicago is Rick Hogan? He's named after one of the city's legendary restaurants. Or was the restaurant named after him? Hey, Rick, congrats, 200. Wow.
That's Bonnie Kolak, album, and I'll tell you more about where Bonnie's playing next Saturday.
Great performer.
Oh, yeah, she's the greatest.
She often comes to Old Town School, thank God.
That's right. We're talking to Dick Simpson, who... He and I go way back with Bonnie Kolak, too. His book, The Good Fight, Life Lessons from a Chicago Progressive. We talked a lot about politics in here. Another aspect of the book, Dick, is your personal life, some of which I knew a little about. But, there are marriages, divorces, death is a leitmotif here.
Right. Yeah, cancer is a killer.
Yeah, but cancer, you write about it very movingly in here. And I'm happy to say, I am very, very happy to read this. In my person, near the very end of this, the book is less than 300 pages, easily devoured. You write, in my personal life, I have fallen in love again. I spend most... I spend more time in Vermont with my partner, Margaret England, and close family. I'm selling the building in Chicago in which Sarah Jane, my son August, and I have lived, and I am downsizing to a smaller apartment. I have new projects underway at the university. Overall, I've experienced life and love in abundance. I have been blessed, and it has been enough. That's a very moving paragraph. You still get great satisfaction out of teaching.
I do. Yeah, it's been, I'd like to say it's been 50 years, and I'm just about to get the hang of it.
Yeah. This book, we've just touched on various things. When you do go back and take the measure of your own life, and you do so here all the way back to your childhood, there had to be some difficult moments in putting this on paper.
Yes. So the first difficulty in writing an autobiography or memoir or a story of this period is, how do you do that? And I had to find the form before I found the words. You know, it's not very well known, but I for more than a decade have written op-eds for different places, different newspapers, and they follow a format of 500 or 650 words if the paper is particularly generous that
yes,
day.
Yes, right. For the same paltry amount of money, if any.
There was a lot of no money and too much.
Thanks for the piece. Yeah.
Yeah. So I decided to write what I thought were vignettes, sort of like a slideshow.
Interesting.
And that then freed me to not have to write from the beginning to the end. I could write pieces as if you were writing a single op-ed, or for you, Rick, it'd be a single column.
Sure.
And that format then, the actual version is 60 of these, and the final book is 30, so it gives you an idea of some of the cutting.
Yeah,
wholesale cutting, not just the cutting in the individual piece. And it worked out to about 1,500 words. And my editor was giving me a little bit of a hard time about even then.
That's what editors are born to do, though.
I couldn't have done this book without Nancy Sayer, my editor. The best editor I've had in 40 years.
Oh, my God, that's what a phrase that is.
And I've done 25 books, something like that. But the reason, so we ended up with this new format. So we'd use 250 words to tell background, like 1968, so you can tell the story.
Right.
And then we'd try and end it like you would an op-ed with some, in this case, so-called lesson. What did I learn from it? They might not learn the same thing. They may not come to the same conclusion, but that gives you an end. So first I had to work out the form, and that took a while.
Yeah, I bet.
Once I worked out the form, then I had to be willing to tell the truth. And one of the rules I had working with my partner, Margaret, and the editor, Nancy, was not to tell things that would be harmful to other people who were alive.
Good for
you. So you had to cut out some parts of the story. But I also didn't want to sugarcoat it. I wanted to tell the truth, and that meant that I had to say what I really failed at. Failed in communication and marriage.
Yeah.
Failed to be the good partner when Sarah Jane first got cancer, because I was in the middle of a congressional campaign and teaching
full
time.
You do. I mean, one of the things of this book is that, you know, life and professional life can really get in the way of personal and emotional life.
Oh, yeah. It's very, very hard to balance everything. And learning to get to balance is one of the things you try and do in life. And it's hard. And you're going to fail. And it's just how you fail and
writing about your first wife, you write, "Losing Scott was the biggest emotional blow of my life. I would go on to suffer many other losses, but none as great as this. After a decade, I would be able to meet her for a friendly cup of coffee and reminisce from time to time. But the wounds of our divorce would never entirely heal. I learned to dance with the limp." That's pretty powerful stuff.
Yeah, that's really the only way you in relationships that are loves and real loves. the loss of them is very painful, and
sure.
It never goes away. But you learn to continue on both sides, and you both grow and you change. And I've been lucky.
Yeah, you have. No, you have, because you had a lengthy relationship with the great Dorothy Stork, who was one of the great writers and reporters in the history of this town. And,
by the way, let me put in a plug, because this is useful not
sure.
only for I was able to convince the Newberry Library to house all of her columns.
Oh, my God.
And for every journalist like yourself,
yeah.
there is a repository for journalists. And Mike Royko's papers are there. Dorothy's papers
oh, yeah.
are there.
They have an ashtray of Mike's there, too.
Yeah, they've got other things. I gave them a few
yeah.
of Dorothy's
yeah.
effects
oh,
as well.
Oh, that's great, Dick. That's great. You can be, it's not my place to tell you this, but you can be terribly proud of not only this book, but also of the life you've led.
Well, I appreciate that.
It is my absolute pleasure. The book is The Good Fight. Good old studs at the end where, you know, I read you the little bit about Dick as a young man talking about being in love with books and movies that had heroes in them. He does short little takes on Leon Dupre, Studs Terkel, Don Clark Netsch, Ray Nordstrand, some of your heroes. You need heroes in life. I'll tell you that. You're one of mine. Dick, congratulations.
Thank you, Rick.
My pleasure. We'll take a break, then we'll get some news, and then we will explore the meaning of selfies.
Hello, Rick. This is Aubrey. Back when I was a little boy, with my little legs dangling off my little chair, I used to read your stories in the newspaper. Now that you're on the radio, I've heard every show that you've ever done. Here's for the 200 you've already done, and at least the 300 plus more that you have to do before we let you go.
Now, that's very sweet, Aubrey Mumpower. When you were a little boy, I'm glad I've been writing since you were a little boy. That warms my heart. A couple of weeks ago, I wrote a piece about a monkey in the jungles of Indonesia who took a photographer had put a camera in the jungle. And while the photographer, was away, at some point a monkey came up and fooled around with the camera and wound up taking a picture of himself, a selfie, what we have come to know as a selfie of himself. And it initiated a kind of PETA got involved, and there was a legal case that went to a couple of different courts before they settled with the photographer. And I, who do not and have never taken a selfie because I'm inept, I can barely send a text message on a phone. It's nothing more than my technological ineptitude that has prevented me from taking a selfie. I decided to explore the whole phenomenon, let me say, of selfies, because they are a part, I think, of our lives. I mean, I know that Lise Graham likes to take them. I see them on her Instagram page and on other social media outlets, and I was lucky enough to discover a book. There may be essays that have been written about selfies, but I was lucky enough to discover a book titled The Selfie Generation: How Our Self-Images Are Changing Our Notions of Privacy, Sex, Consent, and Culture. I wanted to find in the book something about this monkey pal of mine who took the selfie. But I found the book so provocative and so compelling that I devoured it and asked that Alicia Eller come on to talk about it. Alicia, how are you?
Hey, Rick. I'm good. How are you?
Listen, tell me your background. You worked here at the Tribune, did you not?
Rick, I did work at the Chicago Tribune for about a year.
And why didn't we know each other? Because that's the terrible, stupid nature of newspapers now, that we don't all go out drinking and get to know each other really well. And I'm stunned. How did we let you slip away? Do you know?
I don't know. I don't know how I slipped away. I was hired to do, like, this online project, ChicagoNow.com.
Oh,
and I was the arts and entertainment community manager.
Oh, wow.
And when the project ended, and started my position.
Oh, I am so sorry that we did not get to meet, because I'm telling you, you know. When I literally went to your book to say, oh, maybe there's something in here about the monkey, and I found something about the monkey, but I also devoured your book. I cannot tell you how enlightening, it's provocative and enlightening at the same time. Again, it's Selfie Generation, How Our Self-Images Are Changing Our Notions of Privacy, Sex, Consent, and Culture. And one of the great things about you, Alicia Eller, is this is, and I want to know how this happened. It is not intensely personal, but it's wonderfully personal as well as deeply reported. Was that ever your intention?
It was exactly my intention, Rick. What happened was, you know, I had been like taking pictures of myself since really I was a teenager, and you know, when the selfie became a thing, it was around 2013, and I was freelancing for this art magazine, Hyperallergic, and my editor said, "Do you want to do a regular column?" And I said, "Sure." He said, "But what's something you're interested in?" And I said, "Well, this selfie stuff is like every day there's a new selfie story, and they seem to range from like op-eds about like, you know, millennials are awful to like, oh, like a selfie that Anthony Weiner took and sent to some girl.
Right.
Like cat selfies and like, you know, celeb selfies." And I was like, wow, this is like becoming its own sort of 24/7 news cycle. And at the same time, it's, you know, just pictures of oneself.
What your book enlightened me about, among many things, is not just the pervasive nature of it, but the multifaceted use of selfies. Some are indeed, you know, I think there's a common thing, Alicia, that everybody thinks of selfies as some, you know, the manifestation of personal narcissism. When I tend to think, and your book went a long way to convincing me of this, I rather like to think of them, yes, there is that aspect of it, but this is another way for self-expression. To make a big umbrella over it. Don't you think a lot of people, when they hear it, they just knee-jerk that, oh, these are some, you know, narcissistic millennials. I think it's so much, obviously you do, but I think it is so much more than that. I think it's a means of self-expression. We're in this, you know, quick, you know, icy technological age. Kids aren't, especially kids, nobody is sitting down and writing long pieces about themselves. Do you know what I mean? This becomes an easy way to do that.
Yeah, it's an easy way to sort of share, you know, what's going on right now with someone quickly, whether it's like via iMessage or like Snapchat or Instagram, whatever. You know, it's not, I think that the types of selfies that get the really bad rap are ones that sort of appear out of context on social media, or there's like someone who posts a lot of selfies, and then you don't really understand why, and it can feel sort of oppressive to like have like a lot of selfies in your you know, Facebook feed or on your Instagram or whatever.
But
you know, so that's the sort of general bad rap that I think selfies have received, and a lot of that is due largely in part to the people who have been writing about selfies and don't understand even how to use their phone.
Yeah, Alicia, is your this is, as far as I know, the first kind of deep dive in between covers of a book into the selfie generation, is it not?
It is.
Yeah.
It is. And I also wanted to stress that, you know, the selfie generation isn't just about like millennials or people who are younger. It's about anyone who, the selfie generation is really anyone who is engaging with the selfie, with the social media and phones. I mean,
well, which is everybody, you know, now. And I also think that's
which
another
is everybody. And mm-hmm.
you know, that's another kind of knee jerk reaction is, oh, these are just like, you know, I've got a 13-year-old daughter who occasionally will take a selfie, but I think there is this kind of knee jerk mentality again that this is, oh, gee, this is narcissism of the millennials, when in your book you certainly prove that not to be true.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's so many more things, right? It's like, you know, I think about one of my favorite sort of misunderstood selfies, the one with Hillary Clinton in Chapter 4, where it's a, you know, it was an image that was tweeted, and it's a photo of her with a bunch of people, mostly young women, selfieing with her, like turning around and getting a selfie with her at some sort of, you know, she's on the campaign trail.
Right.
And that photo was tweeted by, you know, someone who worked for her, and he just tweeted, like, that image with 2016, y'all. And the internet went crazy.
Yep.
And I've spoken about it. I talk about the selfie a lot when I give book talks. And, you know, talks at colleges and stuff. And I ask people, what's the first thing that comes to mind when you see this photo? And everyone, it's about like 75% of the people in the crowd are like, you know, it's just awful to see that like no one's listening to her and they're just, you know, taking a selfie and like no one's paying attention and everyone's on their phone. I'm like, okay. And then we unpack the image and I'm like, yeah, actually, like everyone was paying attention to her. And then she paused and was like, hey, let's do a photo op. Everyone, you know, get a selfie with
right.
me and hashtag it. I'm with her. It's just purely a marketing opportunity for her. But because of the sort of way that selfies have been stigmatized, that image has been read as, you know, it just fed into this false idea that, you know, millennials, no one cares what anyone's saying and everyone's just on their phones. When actually that was a moment orchestrated by
right.
by Hillary.
Right.
It's just, you know, that's the sort of image that I like to unpack in the book and sort of look at these assumptions that people have made based on an image that they didn't
take a
moment to, like, research.
Exactly,
The internet is so easy not to.
Yeah, and one of the things you bring up occasionally, well, more than occasionally, that kind of what I think of as a self-indulgent selfie taker, even though it may be making her brand, Kim Kardashian, who I think, you know, she has become kind of, for a lot of people who don't do this or don't, you know, Alicia, you're so right. People don't even think about it. But so she's kind of become the poster person for selfies, and it's not healthy for her to be the, that's why people need to read your book. I mean, for God's
sake. Yeah, I mean, Kim K is, you know, that is basically her brand works because she's, you know, she is the most followed person on Instagram. I think she has like 10 million followers or something crazy.
Jesus, that is crazy. That is
yeah,
crazy.
What's interesting about her is that she's also, you know, become this sort of poster person for selfie. But she's also 37.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah.
You know, she said the other day, I was reading something, she said, you know, I'm gonna take selfies till I die, something like that.
Oh, God.
And then I was wondering about how that might actually change standards of beauty. Like, could that, you know, could, what if she starts, you know, what if it becomes a thing where it's like, oh, like 45 is the new 25, or like, could that happen? Because, you know, middle-aged women take way fewer selfies than middle-aged men. You know, and of course we do live in a very sexist culture.
Oh, no question. No question.
I don't know if, you know, what if Kim taking selfies till she dies changes the ways that
we think of aging.
Think
yeah.
themselves
yeah.
and we think about aging.
See, I just think,
I don't know. She's, she may be doing more than she realizes she's doing.
well, I'm sure she's doing more than she realizes. Alicia Eller, can you hang on for like 2 minutes and we'll get some
Definitely.
Commercials and come back?
Okay.
Because one of the things that really moved me about your book, yes, you do talk about my favorite monkey selfie taker in there, but
I mean, you love the monkey selfie.
I do love the monkey selfie. I didn't really think that the monkey needed to be tied up in court, but the monkey itself. was not tied up in court, but it's a fascinating case. What really moved me too? I mean, there's a lot of stuff in the book about sex, selfie sex. But what really kind of moved me was the ways in which people who are kind of alone dealing with an illness use this as a means to kind of reach out and create community. We'll take a little break if that's okay with you, and I'd love to pursue that because I think that is such a wonderfully healthy way that selfies can be used. We'll be right back.
Great.
If you want to pick up a book now, pick up Selfie General, whether you take selfies or not, or whether you see selfies, or whether you know what they are or not. Selfie Generation, How Our Self-Images Are Changing Our Notions of Privacy, Sex, Consent, and Culture. It is an eye-opening and astonishingly readable book, hooked on those pictures people take of one another. Alicia Eller, who the Tribune idiotically let go some time ago, is now the art critic for the Star Tribune in Minneapolis. She is the author of this book. She's a child of Skokie. And Alicia, in the little time we have left, and if you do you ever get to Chicago?
Do I ever get to Chicago?
Yeah. The next time you come here, give me a call. We'll sit down. I'll do an interview and do a piece about this. But we don't do a lot of book coverage anymore in the Tribune, sadly.
But we
do some because obviously you're sensing my enthusiasm for your book.
Definitely.
When you write about, and there are a million, there are a number of different topics that you cover. One of them is the selfies that are shared by people who are sick. And I think they're shared in a way to, sort of help enlighten other people, help inform other people, but also to kind of form a community, because many of the people who are sick are alone.
Yeah. And that was something that really fascinated me about the selfie. I did want to say, Rick, before we get into that,
yes,
I'm going to be in Chicago April 27th for a book talk at the Bookseller.
Fantastic.
In Lincoln Square at 7 p.m. So we'll get together.
We'll coordinate around that. Great.
So you can go.
And the Bookseller, also one of the great independent bookstores in the country. So you picked well. But back to this whole thing, that was one aspect of the whole selfie generation. And by generation, you do not mean some specific crowd. The selfie generation is people of all races and all ages. But that whole illness thing really, really intrigued and moved me, frankly.
Oh, good. Yeah, one of the things that I found in researching that and speaking with a couple of people who organize stuff, like Carolyn Gehrig is an artist in L.A., does the project hashtag Hospital Glam, and then Jenny Grover is actually a Chicago-based writer who does chronicbabe.com, and both of them had a lot of really fascinating things to say about just the ways that people who are sort of dealing with the same chronic illnesses and just the struggle of living with that and are oftentimes, not really able to leave their house. You can't just go and do a meetup like when you're, unable to really, you have no energy. So Carolyn's project, which fascinated me, she does selfies at different, at her doctor's waiting rooms, and oftentimes she looks sort of dressed up, but, the whole project is the space between, what you're like, oh, she couldn't be sick, but she's like, actually, I was about to pass out, getting an IV for something before some sort of procedure, so, what photos lie and what you see is, not necessarily true. So then she hashtagged that with hashtag hospital glam, sort of play with this idea of, looking a certain way, but the reality of the situation is very different. So that project has really caught on, and she has specific rules about how people sh- should use the hashtag, but of course it's the internet, so people just
do whatever they want to do.
You know, and that's, you know, there's a sense of connection in that.
Well, see, one of the things, quotations from the book that I used when I was doing my my little thing about the monkey who took a selfie is that the selfie, and this was very, that it offers the person taking a selfie this element of self-control. And I think it also offers, in a way, a kind of new way of visual storytelling, which is another thing that intrigues me no end. Alicia, I cannot tell you how much I like this book and how important I think this book is, too. It is called...
I'm so glad.
Selfie. I literally went to it to get a quote about a monkey and just wound up devouring the book.
And being terribly provoked
and intellectually provoked and enlightened by it. Its title is Selfie Generation, How Our Self-Images Are Changing Our Notions of Privacy, Sex, Consent, and Culture. It is... a very personal book, but Alicia's reporting is just first rate, and the writing is got a strong narrative drive. I cannot wait to meet you. I'll be in touch before you're... When are you coming to the bookseller?
April 27th.
April 27th, 7 p.m.
Yeah,
I'll be in touch before that, and maybe even do a story. Alicia, it's great to meet you. I think the Tribune was dumb for letting you go. But at least you got a job in journalism at the Art Critic for the Star Tribune in cold, Super Bowl gone Minneapolis. It's a pleasure to meet you on the phone. I wish I'd known you when you were here. I'll be in touch. No question.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon.
Okay, let's take a little thanks. We'll take a commercial break, and then we will, after the news, talk to that Twitter sensation known as the Chicago Party Ant. That is the unbelievably distinctive voice of Bonnie Kolak. In April 2016, a distinctive and wildly amusing new voice came to Twitter. It is the voice, in the words of Chicago Party Ant. In the short time, Chicago Party Ant has accumulated 16,000 followers based on her, let's say, roughly 3,114 tweets and counting. It is, I got to believe that Chicago Party Ant, who was written about a week ago by my colleague Kim Jansen, who did keep the identity of this genius secret, I have been able to arrange for Chicago Party Ant to be on the phone, or I don't know if it's Chicago Party Ant or one of her representatives. Hello? Oh, it's you. It's really you. I've never heard your voice before. It is...
Well. If it isn't the obituary king of Chicago.
You know, it is possible that we know each other, is it not?
It's been a long time, Mr. Kelgen.
Yes, because you invited me. I didn't even know about your genius on Twitter until you asked me to meet you at the Old Town Ale House, which is a very interesting place for us to meet because you do wonderfully run in High Chicago, meaning Gibson's, and Low Chicago, meaning the Ale House. Is there any bar in Chicago you've never visited?
Any bar in Chicago that I haven't visited?
Haven't visited, yes.
Have not visited. No, I've hit them all, Rick. What kind of question is that?
How old are you?
Now, how old am I? Young man, what, you want to know how much I weigh next?
Now you're really calling me young man? You're calling me young man? Then you have to be incredibly old. You're kind of Methuseleh-like, aren't you?
I was just outside shoveling my damn car out and getting dibs ready for the week.
Okay? What do you use for dibs?
Right now I got a vacuum cleaner and a mannequin in a Chicago Wolves starter jacket. Okay, Cal?
You know, you obviously, I know that you smoke. I mean, that I have gotten from your 3,114 tweets and counting. I know that you drink. Your voice is rough. Does it hurt?
I'm a Virginia Slims gal, Rick.
Okay. Yeah.
And if I'm going hard, I'm going Malort.
Well, of course.
If it's a wine night, I'm a Pinot gal. And then Bud Light Lime is my go-to beer. Okay, it used to be Old Style, and I'm switching it up to Bud Light Lime lately.
Let me ask you, Chicago Party Ant, why did you join Twitter?
Because, Rick, people want to know what I'm up to, okay? They want to know where I'm going.
And just in your circle, you wanted to expand your circle, did you not?
Exactly, Rick. I need fellow partiers to come out and meet me and get it going, especially during the week, okay? People aren't partying during the week as much as we used to. Now,
that is
Rick,
true. We must have. I don't know quite who you are, but I have got to imagine you and I seem to have lived some kind of parallel lives. One of your tweets was, and I've been asking this question for the last 15 years, ever since I went on the road with them. One of your questions on Twitter was, hey, at NFL, when are you going to let Styx do the halftime show? That is so close to my heart. That's a dream for me.
Right. Enough with the Gaga. Enough with the Timberlake, okay?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. The other thing...
How about we get some freaking classic rock in there? You know what I'm saying? You're talking to a former loop rock girl, okay, Rick?
Yes. You also, you were not at all loath, Chicago Party Ant, to share the activities of your family members on your Twitter account. I love this one, but I'm going to debate this one with you. You write, my daughters Candace and Krista hold the record for most fights started and won by sisters at Cork and Kerry. I know a lot of sisters who would beg to differ. Are you sure they hold the record?
Well, there's a plaque behind the bar that says they do.
There is a plaque behind the bar at Cork and Kerry that does that. You have an amazing ability, Chicago Party Ant, to go from what we would consider sort of ritzy Chicago, meaning Gibson's, to kind of real neighborhood Chicago area. You just gave a rave about Berwyn, for instance, which is one of my favorite suburbs. Do you have a job beyond Twitter?
Do you work
for a living?
Rick, I do cut and color at Fantastic Sam's, okay? So, of course, I have a job.
And this affords you the ability to... Have you ever paid for a drink in the last 10 years? Have you paid for a drink ever? In the last 10
Never,
years.
Rick.
Never.
Listen, I'm an Old Town Ale House girl. I'm a mother's gal. I hang out at the Lodge. You can find me at Streeter's, okay? I'm over at the Red-Headed Piano Bar. I'm over at the Green Door Tavern. You can find me drinking at Kingston Mines. And no, I haven't paid for a drink in the last 15 years.
15? Oh, that beats me by 5 years. Chicago Party Ant, I have got to meet you face-to-face. Are you... What does 16,000 Twitter followers mean to you? I think you have such a distinctive Chicago voice and are wildly amusing. I'm going to read some of my favorite Chicago Party Ant tweets. For instance, just knocked over a kid in a wheelchair to get the last space heater at Home Depot. Were we ever married?
Listen, the kid was in my way, okay?
Yeah.
It's Snowmageddon 2018. We're hitting wind chills of negative 10 right now, okay? So
I know.
So get the hell out of my way, kid, okay?
Yeah. But my last question.
Dems and does.
But now, these, Rick, is this true also? Chicago Party Ant, you said in a tweet that you just punched an old lady in the face for the last gallon of milk at White Hen. It's Snowmageddon, and it's every man, woman, and child for themselves. How hurt was that old lady? Or do you care?
I don't care how
hurt
of course. I needed a gallon of 2%, okay, Rick?
Yes.
We're stocking up like it's Y2K over here, all right?
Now, how did you let that Tribune reporter interview you? I found that amazing.
Well, oh, yeah. Well, that was the story of that guy's life, I'll tell you what.
That's like, that was Watergate for him. He's now the Woodward. He's Woodward and Bernstein of Chicago party end. When can I?
No. Huh. Yeah, and I'm deep throat. Okay, pal.
Oh, I've got that. I know that. Chicago party end. What can I do to entice you to come and sit in this studio? Will I have to do a live broadcast from the Billy Goat? Would that do it?
Oh my God!
Would that do it?
It would be a pleasure. The last time I was in Tribune Tower, I think I was, I actually was up on the roof, and I smoked a joint up there with, let's see, Ronnie Woo Woo was there, Billy Deck was there, Steve Dahl was up there with us, and Billy Corgan, and we had one of the best nights of our lives up there on the roof of the Tribune Tower.
I'm sure they had a good time. Did you, too, have a good time with that crowd?
Oh, I had a good time, baby.
Okay, baby.
But they definitely had a better time.
I can only imagine.
Now, Steve Dahl says this demolition night was his idea. He stole that from me, okay?
Yeah. Oh, I knew. You were starting the fires out there, weren't you?
That's right. And they call me the Hammond Horseshoe Queen, Horseshoe Casino Queen.
Yes, of course.
Earned that nickname, okay, pal?
Now, one of the things, before I let you go, Chicago Party Ant, and we should do this on a regular basis, you have a wide, wide range of drinking buddies. Here is one I never expected to hear. You write on Twitter, nobody, and I mean nobody, parties harder than Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle. I tried going shot for shot with this babe at Dick's Last Resort last year. 6 hours in, I'm puking off the patio into the river while Preckwinkle's holding my hair back and slamming a Jaeger bomb. That is, does she still see you? Do you still go out drinking with Tony?
Nobody parties harder than Preckwinkle, okay?
Okay.
Put that on her tombstone. You write her obituary, put it on her tombstone. Nobody parties harder than Preckwinkle.
Chicago.
Now, Rick,
yes.
You keep going on and on about how we've never met and how convenient.
I'm wondering,
you're not mentioning the time that you proposed to me at the Old Town Ale House.
Oh, you're one of a big crowd who could claim that. You are one of a very big crowd.
Let me paint a picture for your listeners, okay?
Thank
you. Me, Mike Royko, Studs Terkel, Roger Ebert, and Bruce Elliott, and we're all sitting belly up at the bar, okay?
Okay.
And you, of course, don't remember. You were three sheets to the wind on Old Style Light and Malort.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And right before
two of my favorite drinks that I've never had in my life. But I can carry on.
Bar closed. Everybody knows 4 a.m. during the week, 5 a.m. on the weekend.
You bet.
You get down on one knee right next to the jazz jukebox, okay? You pop a question. Okay, so you're over here telling your listeners we've never met before. I remember I looked over at the bar, Roger Ebert's giving two thumbs up, okay? The next day I see you at a 16-inch softball game up by Montrose, and you had no recollection.
I am so ashamed of myself, Chicago Party Ant. You should see
Ed,
you should see me. I am ashamed of myself. You're also saying that same evening that Mike Royko did not propose to you also? Because we used to be a team. We used to be a team like that.
He was too busy telling mushballs stories. Now, I understand, Rick, that you are named after a restaurant, a former Chicago restaurant called Ricardo's. Am I wrong on that?
No, you're right on there. Were you ever there?
I was never there, but I named my third son Ed DeBevick.
Well, what a charming name. What a charming name.
Right.
Ed DeBevick, and there's no last name, right? You can't say.
Correct.
You can't
say. No last name, but it ends in ski, S-K-I.
Of
now,
course.
We all know that Kim and Kanye recently named their kid Chicago.
Yes.
Yes. Well, funny because they stole my idea. I named my sixth son Elk Grove Village.
I think I read that on Twitter because I am among your 16,000 and counting followers. Chicago Party Ant, when are you coming into the studio?
Whenever you'll have me, baby.
Okay, baby. I'm sorry I never took you up on the proposal, but I am getting an incredible amount of enjoyment living vicariously through you. You have as distinctive and wildly amusing a Chicago voice as exists on Twitter or in print or anywhere else. Carry on, I will tell you.
Rick,
carry on.
You, my friend, are a Chicago legend. Happy 200th episode.
And go yeah, how
go Bulls. Go Bears. Go Cubs.
And go Sticks. We need Dennis DeYoung at the next Super Bowl, don't we?
We sure do, and I'm going to write a letter.
Write a letter to the NFL, Chicago Party, and a distinct and unforgettable pleasure. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Don't eat my bagel sandwich at the Chicago Bagel Authority.
That's right. You got sandwiches. Now, that's right. I forgot. I will. I will do that first thing in the morning. Take care, Chicago Party Ant. You are a burgeoning Chicago legend, man. Burgeoning
love
Chicago
you,
legend. Love you, too. Love you, too.
Congrats on 200, baby.
Thank you. I'm trying to make it to 201. We will be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Right back. We've been trying to play some music from Bonnie Kolak from her CD Here to Sing, and that is because Bonnie will be Saturday night at the Woodstock Opera House, which is an incredible venue in Woodstock. Go to BonnieKolak.com to get tickets. I think it's near selling out, but that is a perfect place to hear the one and only Bonnie Kolak. She's been a guest on the show a number of times. She's an old dear friend, and she is one of the greatest singers to ever hit a stage in Chicago, and the Woodstock Opera House is a charming, beautiful venue. 8 p.m. Saturday night. Go to BonnieKolak.com. At the Red Orchid Theater, because the show is being directed by the one and only Michael Shannon, who is a member of that theater and a big movie star these days. One of the actresses in the show is Natalie West, and Natalie West, who will be on the new, you know, the resurrected Roseanne show, because she was part of the original Roseanne show, but she's a great actress and a great woman. And she and her husband, Keith Moore, have a wonderful daughter named Zita Moore, who has done some theater and movie reviews for this show. And here is Zita Moore reviewing her mother's show. It's called Traitor.
When Heinrich Ibsen wrote An Enemy of the People, I doubt he envisioned his monumental vision transplanted into the machinations of a suburban blowhard hell-bent on destroying his life. Well, it's a relief that Brett Neveu did. In Traitor, his adaptation of Ibsen's classic, masterfully directed by the inimitable Michael Shannon at a Red Orchid Theater, everything in the kitchen sink hits the fan, and everyone has to deal with the schmutz. Tom Stock, played by Guy Van Swearingen, exposes the problem of lead contamination beneath the charter school of his so-called suburban utopia. His wife, Carla, played by Dado, mercifully attempts to dissuade him from committing political suicide. Guess how all that goes? Grateful to tag along on this fatal voyage of misguided justice, we meet Walter, played by Larry Grimm, a clueless journalist who may even have less of a backbone than our resident blowhard. His assistant, Madison, played by Kristen Ellis, provides an infectious humor to the show as everyone crumbles around her. And you can be sure people oversee the crumbling. Patty, played by Kirsten Fitzgerald, aims to reintroduce Tom to his self-righteousness and narcissism at the cost of her sanity. Jen Sheffer, played by Natalie West, deals an equal amount of damage by taking petty suburban politics to feral lengths. And then we have Molly, played by Missy Davis, who may have the most vindicating coming-out scene in current theater. You'll find out why in good measure. Additionally, you can be sure to experience a riveting town council scene in an adjoining building, accompanied by Fran Wysocki, played with aplomb by Mary Jo Bolduc, and Eric Ride, played by the highly exceptional Jacob Alexander. Most amusing are Bill Strand, played by Stephen Walker, and an incredibly funny bespectacled extra who is so good at being an extra that I thought he needed to get a life and do something more fun than hang out at a town council meeting. Sadly, I cannot extend the same benevolence to Howard Keel, played by Frank Nall. Carla's terrifying father. The devil is at play here, and in no one's performance does he feel more alive than Nall's. In the wake of the madness festering in the adults of the aptly named Eastlake, it is Randall, played by Nation Henriksen, who attempts to remind the whole of his small circle that they need to take their heads out of their behinds. Suffice to say, some of them are not quick to listen. If this sounds like another maddeningly relevant and jaw-dropping spectacle magisterially brought to life by Red Orchid Theater, believe me when I say that you're hearing this right. The fabric of our security blankets is collectively burning, but we can have all the fun in the world watching them smolder.
That was Zeta Moore reviewing her mother's show, Traitor. There are a lot of other actors in it, but her mom's Natalie West. Show's directed by Michael Shannon. I think it's very difficult to get tickets, but go to a Red Orchid Theater with an RE.org. Thanks so much for listening to the 200th show. Lise Graham's a sweet, sweet, sweet young lady, and went to extremes. When you get Aubrey Mumpower talking about growing up reading Rick Kogan when he was a young man with his legs hanging off the side of the bed, you know you've done something special. So thanks, Aubrey. Thanks, Lise. Thanks, Roger Badish. Thanks, especially all of you for listening. See you next week.